All right, welcome. Good morning. You are at the Boone Center for the Family Lecture Series here, and I am delighted to welcome Dr. Len Matheson for us this morning. And Len is a neurorehabilitation psychologist who was a professor at Washington University for a number of years, recently published a book, Your Faithful Brain. And Len is actually a friend and mentor to me from my days in St. Louis as a student, so it's especially fun for me to have him here today. And Len has a Pepperdine history himself. He was a student at Pepperdine before the Malibu campus, so back at the downtown campus. And this is, as I understand, Len's first time on the Malibu campus here. So Len is going to present on parenting and leading for character development and brain health. So please give him your attention. And
thank
welcome,
you.
Len.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm actually a wavelet. My dad was an undergraduate in 1948, and I was a year and a half old, toddling around the old campus. So I couldn't toddle around this campus. It's just too steep. But back in South Central, it was okay. I'm delighted to be here. This is a home. This is a community that is very, very special to me because I came back to Pepperdine after a very troubled adolescence. I came back to Pepperdine when I was 21 years old after not doing well as an undergraduate. And part of my redemption, both spiritually and emotionally, is intimately tied up with Pepperdine. And I knew I was back at Pepperdine when my wife and I drove in off of Malibu Canyon Drive, and the security guard, I'll put security in quotes because he said, "Hi, welcome!" It wasn't like, "Can I check your ID, please?" And he was sincere. It was just delightful. My first day back on campus, back in South Central LA, after having such a troubled undergraduate elsewhere, was marked by an experience that was salutary for me. It really began me back towards God, towards emotional health. Because as I walked from where I had just signed up for my classes at the psych clinic over to the bursar where I needed to pay for my tuition, I had seven people say, "Hi." And that hadn't happened on this other big campus that will go unnamed. It's very famous, but nowhere near as friendly. So the attachment that I have, that as you, some of you stuck around, or are sticking around after Kelly's talk, secure attachment is exemplified in the Pepperdine experience. I'm really delighted to be back and participate and feel that again. Today we're going to be talking about character development, and I'm going to be focusing on character development. I'll talk about brain health as well. My background is about 50 years now working with people with brain injuries, very serious traumas. Really bad things that happened to people. I started out with working with teenagers who had really serious problems. And one of the things that I noticed as I worked with these teens over the years, and I followed some of them, now a few of them are old men, like me. One of the things I noticed about them was the difference between the kids who spectacularly crashed and burned after the brain injury and other bad things that happened to them, spinal cord injuries, things like that. Or the kids who did really well and had become successful adults in every way you can imagine had to do with character. And I started to recognize that very early in my career. And a lot of it had to do with how they were parented. Now, we talk about character, and we don't really have many ways to put our hands around it. And I want to give you a couple of ways today to do that. And I think there's a handout there. Can I get one of those handouts? Is there one? All right. I'm going to introduce this to you, have you take it home. I actually want you to use this in the bathtub tonight when you're reviewing our marvelous experience here. to get yourself started in doing something that's a tool that I use with my clients, with my students, having to do with character development. In order to get there, I need to introduce a new idea to you called character strengths, introduced by two really important people in American psychology, Chris Peterson and Martin E.P. Seligman. Marty was the president of the APA several years ago when he introduced the idea of positive psychology. And this is their hallmark book, talking about character strengths and virtues. They identified 24 character strengths and organized that into six different virtue categories. They founded the Values in Action Institute, which is a very important entity that's an international program to help people develop character strengths and move forward towards a higher quality of life. And I think the last time I looked, they had about 2 million participants. So it's a huge, I think 123 different countries, huge enterprise that I want to introduce to you.
Could I interrupt for just a minute? If you could speak a little bit more into the microphone.
Will do. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. So one of the important issues that Peterson and Seligman identified has to do with what's the difference between character traits and character strengths. Character traits have to do with what most of us do most of our development during adolescence. We have a lot of character traits that we develop, and some of those get moved on into adulthood, and so we're known in terms of our particular character traits. Character traits is where most of us have started in the past, psychologists looking at character and personality and so forth. Peterson and Seligman introduced the idea of strengths, which is character traits, but they improve the quality of life. There are things that actually move you forward in terms of life to the full, to the degree that they are present in your life. Character traits can be positive or negative. Character strengths are always positive. I want you to keep that in mind. That's really useful. Those of you who are counselors, character strengths is a really useful way to look at people who might otherwise be quite troubled. If you're working with clients professionally, you really have a lot to learn, help your clients learn, and a really, really safe space within which to help them grow if you're focusing on character strengths, which is an idea I want to share with you today. With character traits, there are many exemplars of people who have different character traits. We can take a look every morning in the paper for people who are famous, who've got certain character traits. They're known for certain aspects of their personality. There are a lot of examples of those. There are very few paragons of character strengths. A paragon is a person who, you can't think of a person who does this particular character strength better. And that's an important issue to consider. Now, in the Character Strengths and Virtues textbook, they did a lot of really good work, but Jesus doesn't appear very often. The name Jesus shows up 4 times in the book. He is used as an exemplar only once, and it's okay. But it hurt me when I read that. I went through that, and I got it. This book has been an important addition to my professional career, but it really didn't fit very well with my integrated spiritual and professional and personal life. So I use it as an important text. I would encourage you to take a look at it, but just realize that it's missing something. And the Values in Action movement, which is a very powerful movement, from my perspective, is missing something. So when I, about 15 years ago, started to take a look at that mismatch, I was moved to do something about it. I really wanted to do something about it. I'd been working with character as an issue for 15 years, actually 35 years at that point, and recognized how important it was and how important this idea that they've given us about character strengths. But missing Jesus as part of the formula? No, that didn't work for me. So I wrote a book called Your Faithful Brain, Designed for So Much More. Actually, this book took a long time to write, 5.5 years, because I really wanted to integrate what I knew about neuroscience and what I was experiencing in faith. Not just my own personal faith journey, but the faith journey of so many of my clients over the years. And one of the things I was seeing as a person who gradually became a Christian psychologist and a Christian neuropsychologist was that the people who had an active relationship with Christ did better in spite of horrible trauma than people who didn't, just generally speaking. There's a huge potent effect as we take a look at that. So I wanted to do the best I could and make this accessible. This is not a textbook. I did use it as a textbook when I taught later at Covenant Seminary with my master's students, but that's because I wanted to sell books. It's a good compilation. I think you'll like it. It's written, though, for people who are not neuroscientists. It's written for, actually, I wrote it for my my son. And when he read it, he says, oh, that's why what would Jesus do is such an important question. Ah, thank you, God. Some friends of mine and I founded something called the Faithful Brain Institute, and kind of as a counter to the Values in Action Institute, although we haven't gained much traction. We aren't very good marketers and businessmen, so we're kind of, it is a labor of love. But one of the things that we've done with it is develop some strategies for faithful brain counseling, working with men and women with issues that are very serious, depression, anxiety, some of the real serious mental disorders, serious traumas, working with couples, doing what we call faithful brain counseling with these folks, and that's what's laid out in the book. We also developed something that, one of which I've handed to you this morning, called the Character Strengths Rating Scale. This is an instrument that I use in my counseling and I teach my counseling students to use with their clients. I'm going to use it with you just a little bit here. We used it to, as part of a psychological study of Christian character strengths. It was important to me to be able to start to move, to make some headway into the Values in Action Institute's approach that wasn't Christian, that kind of, it did ignore, it, for the most part, ignore Jesus. I wanted to make some headway, and so I decided, well, we need to do a study. We need to do a serious psychological study, asking the question, how do Christian character strengths relate to quality of life? How do Christian character strengths relate to quality of life? Every weekend we hear from our pastors that that's the case. The Bible makes the case that that's the case. But can we actually demonstrate that scientifically? And I thought, well, yes, we can. I'd had a long career in academic medicine. I'd retired from academic medicine and took this job at Covenant Seminary back in St. Louis, teaching graduate students in counseling. And my own experience as a professional counselor and also as just a client of professional counselors was that this was true. Christian character strengths do relate to quality of life in a positive way. But that may raise a question in your mind. What are Christian character strengths? Is it, how do we deal with that? How do we actually operationally identify Christian character strengths? What we settled on after several pilot studies and a lot of work is using an instrument like this instrument in the major study, and asking people to rate themselves, compare yourself to Jesus. Now that's jarring for a lot of people. Some people it just goes over their head, oh, I can do that. It's an important issue for us to grapple with, each of you personally to grapple with. If you are a counselor, it's a fantastic position to take, because your clients will not be able to say about themselves as they compare themselves to Jesus that, oh yeah, I'm a 10 out of 10 or 9.5 out of 10, I'm right there. You just, I mean, if you're serious about it, no. Well, I'm probably out of 10, I'm probably out of 3. Well, if you're comparing yourself to Jesus, that's actually okay. And Jesus tells you that. The Bible says that. The Bible welcomes you in and says, you can be a 3. I am going to make you perfect. Come in and join me. Come in and be in relationship with me. Come in and be in a secure attachment with me. And I love you out of your weakness. So, And in counseling, if you're working with clients who are, for instance, very depressed, and they come in and they rate themselves twos and threes out of ten across the scale, they look at that and the people who are kicking the tires with their faith, or people who are actually deeply engaged in their faith, they both have a positive opportunity. They look at it as an opportunity to get more deeply engaged with God, to revive their prayer life, to get involved with the church again, all these kinds of positive things that we get out of participating with God in this adventure that we call life. And so there's a lot of positive to be gained there. Now, if the person is comparing themselves across 24 character strengths to the president, or to Abraham Lincoln, or to Mahatma Gandhi, pick all the different people that you can take as famous, some of whom are paragons, most of whom are just exemplars, they're not really at the top of the curve, then they start to feel less than. And I could never be as rich as, or as famous as, or whatever. But comparing yourself to Jesus has no downside potential and a lot of upside potential across a very broad range. And later on, when we've got time to sit around and talk about this over a cup of coffee, I want to share with you some of the other ideas, but I want about that if you're interested. But we need to go forward with this. We don't have that much time. So we laid out something called the Life to the Full Survey. We developed an online survey, 72 items, with the 24 character strengths, Christian character strengths, 48 other items. The statistics that we were going to use, some advanced statistics, required that we have 960 subjects altogether. It's a big study, big study, one of the biggest that I've been involved with over my years, looking at the relationship between quality of life and faith practices, healthy brain habits, and character strengths. So we went out and looked for funding, got shot down, no funding. This was the idea of comparing yourself to Jesus is not a very politically acceptable idea right now. And I've got good credentials in academic medicine as a psychologist and doing some things with good grant funding and so forth. But I couldn't get any grant funding for this. So we said, okay, we better talk to our wives and see if we can fund this ourselves. And so my wife Mary, who's here, said, go for it. My partners, Tony and Mark, their wives said, go for it. So we spent the next year and a half unfunded doing the study. We actually were able to identify and have participated 976 people. So really substantial response. Good response from both men and women. It was amazing to us that only 85% of the people were Christians. You think that comparing yourself to Jesus, okay, well that leaves out Jewish people, that leaves out atheists, that leaves out you name it, Muslims, Buddhists, not true. Jesus is famous enough in all those communities. In fact, in the Muslim community, he is he's very highly revered. In the Jewish community, they're not sure what to make of him, but he's famous. He's a good Jewish boy for a lot of the folks that I know in the Jewish community. So they were able to participate in this. Excuse me. And we got some great data. And I've got a frog I need to take care of here. And this is what we found. We found that several of the factors that we looked at were positively related to quality of life. We looked at faith practices and found four of the 24 faith practices were positively related to quality of life. I thanked God for creating me. I took time to seek God's purpose in my life. My life has meaning and purpose. And life to the full is a combination of my physical, mental, and spiritual selves. People responding to those, the question was, in the last week, to what degree do you find this has been true in your life over the last week? It was a rating scale for each of these, 1 to 4, 1 to 5, depending upon the construct. And so, to the degree that people answered these in the higher level, they had higher quality of life. So that's a simple correlation, and that's a good way to start a research project. looking at healthy brain habits, we had 24 healthy brain habits we asked people about. These four were related to higher quality of life. I met my commitments. I asked for and received emotional support from others. This is in the past week. I read holy scriptures and they calmed me. I got at least 6 hours of deep and restful sleep each night. Now, if you take a look at those as healthy brain habits, some of you are going to think, wait a minute, how does reading holy scripture be a healthy brain habit? Part of what we can't talk about now because we don't have time, but I'm going to propose to Kelly that she puts into her work in the future, is that the neurobiology of what you're doing with relationship IQ and the neurobiology of reading the Bible is solid. There's terrific neuroprotective factors that occur as we calm and read holy scriptures. And then the 6 hours of deep and restful sleep is absolutely crucial. When Kelly asked me, how'd you do last night? I told her this morning, as Mary and I showed up, I got 5 sleep cycles last night. I'm always looking for 5 sleep cycles. I don't always get 5 sleep cycles. I usually about 4. A sleep cycle is about 90 minutes. If I get 6 sleep cycles, I'm dangerous. 5 sleep cycles, I'm just fine. 4 sleep cycles, I can do okay. But I got 5, so I'm really here and ready to go. 6 Christian character strengths were identified out of the 24 as being demonstrably, scientifically, statistically, significantly, and some of them really potently, highly related to quality of life. And I'm going to share some of that with you later. Hope, vitality, leadership, curiosity, perspective, and kindness. All of which, now, these character strengths, 24 character strengths in the work that Peterson and Seligman have done, all 24 of them are highly related to quality of life. In this work we've done, taking a look at Christian character strengths and looking at faith practices and healthy brain habits, 6 come up. Now, this is very useful for us. It's not that those other 18 character strengths aren't positive. I'm not saying that at all. It's that from a counselor's perspective, from a parent's perspective, which 6 should you really be paying attention to as best you can? And these are the 6, along with the healthy brain practices, healthy faith practices, and brain health fitness practices. So these are the, I'm going to present these to you as the 6 that we're really paying attention to. Hope, expecting the best in the future and working to achieve it, believing that a good future is something that can be brought about. And you have these all here, by the way. I've given these all to you. If you take a look down through, hope is the second one down on your sheet. The research that we did moved us from a 10-point rating scale to a 5-point rating scale. One of the good outcomes of the technology of our research. The next key character strength is vitality, going down a little further. Approaching life with excitement and energy, not doing things halfway or half-heartedly, living life as an adventure, feeling alive and activated. These two, kindness and leadership, are a little bit further down in the next quadrant there. Kindness is doing favors and good deeds for others, helping them, taking care of them. Leadership, encouraging a group of which one is a member to get things done and maintain good relations within the group. Organizing group activities and seeing that they happen. Now, I'm going to keep going through these. I want you to start thinking, where would you be in relation to Jesus? Taking a look at, for instance, kindness. How was Jesus in doing favors and good deeds for others, helping them, taking care of them? He was a paragon. On this 5-point scale, would you rate yourself as a 1, 2, 3, 4? Could you go up to 5, or would you just aspire to 5? That's an important personal question for you. And those of you who are parents or planning to become parents, I want you to take this to heart, because to the degree that you can demonstrate that in the way you live your lives, not just teach it, but demonstrate it, you're going to be able to help your children develop these crucial Christian character strengths. Going on, down in the last quadrant there, curiosity, taking an interest in ongoing experience for its own sake, finding subjects and topics fascinating, exploring and discovering. Perspective, being able to provide wise counsel to others, having ways of looking at the world that make sense to oneself and to other people. So before we go any further, let me just point out something that you just might have gone over your head just a moment ago. This is organized into three different sections. The top section, we talk about it being vertically integrated. The top section has character strengths that are closely integrated with your faith journey. We call it vertically integrated with the idea that we're integrated with God. And these are the first ones that I deal with in my counseling with clients. These are the ones I start with. I want to have everything that I do in terms of developing character strengths be within the context that God provides us in a relationship with God. So the first two that you saw there, I have to go back and remind myself, I get into all of them. Vitality and kindness, hope and vitality are in the top group. The next two are in the next group, which has to do with your interpersonal, your relationships, your attachment to others. So you've got attachment to God in the first group, attachment to others in the second group, and then intrapersonal is in the third group. And if you're a counselor, keep that in mind, because you really do want to encourage your clients to come from a top-down approach if you can. So, how do character strengths develop? I'm going to ask you to do this with me in just a moment, but I want to explain something to you before we get there. This is a representation of the neural networks in your brain. This is a neuron being actuated by an axon coming into another neuron onto the neuron cell line. The neuron has dendrites coming out of it. If you're a person in your early 40s and relatively healthy, you've got about 100 billion neurons in your brain. If you're 4 years old, you've got about 200 billion. I'm at age 72. I'm on the downswing. I've got about maybe 82 billion. Oh, never mind. I'm making the most of what I've got left. Now, what's happening here is that this is slowed down 1,000 times. Each neuron in your brain, each of the, let's say, 100 billion neurons, has 3,000 to 60,000 connections, depending upon the type of neuron it is and where in the brain it is. So we say on average that each of the 100 billion neurons has 10,000 connections on average. Now, each of those connections fires intermittently. Like, not all the connections are firing, right? Some of them are, some of them aren't. Some of them are firing to send a signal to the next neuron to fire. Some of them are firing to send a signal to the next neuron to not fire. It's not common to communicate like that. There are 38,000 trillion operations per second going on in your brain. 38,000 trillion. And the number of possible connections is a word I invented many years ago called Godzillion. And the reason I invented that word, my pastor loves to use it, is to make the point that only God can fully comprehend what he has created. We are just barely touching. I spent the last 15 years of my academic career at the Washington University School of Medicine, sort of the Human Genome Project this year. Human Genome Project has a system that's set up to study the mouse brain that has reached its maximum capacity in terms of its ability to store information. It's gone on from that to start to study the human brain, but it's only able to study a very small segment of the human brain. And so God's up to the chore, and that's why I use the word Godzillion. I don't expect... What I want to do is to focus in on one part of the brain that's really crucially important to helping ourselves, helping our children develop character strengths, and that's the hippocampus. I'm going to put this down. Put your hands out like this for a moment. Put your thumb over as far as you can, and then wrap your fingers down and put your hands together. Now, these are the two hemispheres of your brain, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. The top part of your brain is the cerebral cortex. This down here is the limbic system. The cerebral cortex is your thinking, volitional, this is what I want to do with my life, planning kind of brain. Down here is your emotional brain, your limbic system. The hippocampus is right here, part of the limbic system that touches the bottom of the cerebral cortex. Right here, at the tip of your thumb, is your amygdala. It's your fight or flight or freeze warning system. And the amygdala and the hippocampus have a lot of connections. An important part of what we do as counselors is helping people at that connection learn not to be afraid of everything, learn not to have PTSD reactivity by helping people change the junction between those two parts of their brain. And we do it with counseling, we do it with practice. And one of the things I'm going to do with you right now is to move you towards making some changes in your hippocampus. So you need to know a little bit about the hippocampus. It's where all the information that's going into your brain right now is stored for a few hours. A little bit of it will be available to you tonight when you go to sleep. A little more of it will be available at lunchtime when you talk with people. But it gradually drops off. And then most of it's lost. The hippocampus is the first stage.
Thanks.
The hippocampus is your first stage for learning. That's Mary. Mary, stand up and take it. So all the information goes into your hippocampus, stays there briefly. And it's where neuroconsolidation starts. Neuroconsolidation is a fancy word that has to do with the networks that were being fired there. Some of them get strengthened because they fire frequently. Networks that aren't being fired there become weak. And actually, if a neuron is not used very much, it actually dies. Almost all the neurons that you were born with, when you were 4 years old, you had 200 billion neurons. When you get to be 96 and say goodbye to this planet, most of those neurons that you had at age 4, most of the neurons that you died with were around when you were 4 years old. You will add a few neurons as you go along, but not that many. Now, what happens between age 4, 200 billion neurons, and age 25, if you're a male, 23, if you're a female, with the drop-off of neurons and the ability of the brain to mature? The brain develops from back to front, from top to bottom. Female brains complete that development about 2.5 years earlier than male brains. So the ability of the thinking brain to control and integrate the actions of the emotional brain doesn't actually get done for most men until they're 25, for most women until they're 22. And a lot of the development has to do with pruning neurons. So as you go from age 2, 3, or 4 up until you're 25, you're losing a lot of neurons that you aren't using. And that's why so much character development takes place in your adolescence. And much less of it as you get into adulthood. But you can still do it. You can still do character strength development, and I'll be doing that with you in just a moment, in adulthood. The key issue I want you to take away, though, is that the hippocampus does most of its work at night. Neuroconsolidation, it's active during the day, but the neuroconsolidation part of it mostly takes place at night, while you sleep. So, Paul had it right when he said, "Do not conform anymore to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you can test and approve what God's will is for your life, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." I tell people who will listen to me that he was the first neuroscientist, because he got it exactly right. He didn't miss a piece of that. And I could get up on my soapbox. I won't, because we don't have much time. But question I would pose to you: how can Carl or Sally or Frank or Alice support Christian character formation? By doing the healthy hippocampus exercise. I call it the healthy hippocampus exercise for normal folks, my students, you folks. When people come to me who are severely depressed, and that's the signal issue that people come to me for, real serious depression, suicidal depression,
I call it the happy hippocampus exercise because I want to jar them into realizing they have some significant control over interacting with their depression. And this is it. Bring three episodes to mind about how you were more, whichever character strength you want to develop, today than yesterday as you go to sleep. Bring three episodes to mind about how you were more courageous today, merciful today. Pick a character strength you want to work on and work on it for 30 days, 30 nights, and you will see changes in the character strength. Now, part of it is harnessing your hippocampus, but that's not all of it. The bigger part of it is changing your behavior, because three episodes during the day where you were different in that particular character strength than the day before is a cognitive behavioral therapy approach, sneaky one, to bring about behavior change that brings about attitude change, that brings about changing your values and beliefs. So, who would like to volunteer with me to have their hippocampus changed? Yes, please. What's your name? Vince, you can stay there, Vince. Taking a look at the character strengths rating scale now. And if you wouldn't mind identifying one or another that you're fairly weak on that you'd like to develop, something you'd like to work on over the next month? Okay. Where is that? Right in the middle of the first section, letting one's accomplishments speak for themselves, not regarding oneself as more special than one is. And where would you rate yourself in terms of humility?
A one or a two.
So you'd like to become more proud about being humble? Is that what you're telling me?
My personality is that of a three. My
yeah, that makes sense, sure.
And I'm well aware of that, so being more humble would benefit my daily life.
Excellent, and you're probably right. And you know, Paul talks about that a lot, and so I'm glad you're picking that. I just want to thank you for doing that. Vince, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what I'm going to ask you to do, Vince, is today identify three episodes in which you're more humble today than you were yesterday. And as you get ready to drop off to sleep tonight, along with your gratitude prayers, along with getting yourself ready to have a good night's sleep, I want you to bring the three episodes to mind where you were more humble today than you were yesterday. Okay? Now, let me point out that you've already selected one of them. Right? Did everybody notice that he's already got one up?
Yes.
Okay, so it's relatively easy to get one. He's wondering, what? Well, you opened yourself up here. You were humble about who you are and your need to develop something that's important to you. So you're one or two now, and you've got one example of how you're more humble today than you were yesterday. Through the day, you're going to need to come up with two more examples. Now, that's not just something you have to think about. That's something you actually have to do. And so, as you get ready to go to bed tonight, and you've come up with one more, so you've got two now at 7 p.m. this evening, but you've only got a couple of hours before you're dropping off to sleep, you've got to figure out what's the third one. And that's going to bring about behavior change that the first week or so is going to be a bit uncomfortable, because you are already low-rated on humility. You're probably going to have to manufacture a humility task and do it before you drop off to sleep. And it'll be difficult for the first couple of days, maybe up to a week. But you will get, it'll get easier, you get better at it, because you're actually developing the neural networks that support humility in your brain. And you'll be absolutely amazed that the combination of your behavior change and the people around you are going to notice it. It'll make it easier for you to be expected to be more humble, and they're going to probably like you a lot more, be more comfortable in your presence. And that will reinforce your new humility behavior. And that day after day after day will create neural networks that support humility. Now, the reason 30 days is important is that you are still creating new neurons in your brain. Guess where? In the hippocampus. to go from a stem cell to a full-fledged working neuron takes 21 days. And so a new neuron, a humility neuron, is being birthed in your brain right now. Not many, but a few. And over the next 3 months, most of the time, you'll do this each night. That humility neuron, that new baby neuron, is going to be recruited to be part of Vince's humility neuron network. It's going to take you on through the rest of your life. Okay, some ideas or questions, concerns? Yes, please.
So you just pick one, and would you suggest just to pick one off the list to work on for 30 days?
Yes, pick one to work on for 30 days. Part of it is that you need to be convinced that it works, but part of it is that it's a lot of work. And one of the things you'll notice, by the way, Vince will notice, is that the in each of the categories, the constructs kind of hang together. So as he improves his humility, some of the others that are in that same area begin to improve. His faith is probably going to improve, because humility is an important part of our faith journey, isn't it? And it's probably, Vince, as you take a look at wanting to develop humility, I imagine the mismatch between your lack of humility and your faith journey has been something that's kind of motivating you to pick humility as a construct to work on.
Yeah, I would rate myself a little bit much higher, just because I have that. I believe that I'm a minister. That's my life. I'm a children's minister, so I.
Wow, that's great.
I teach birth to fifth grade Sundays, Wednesdays, and I'm at the office, at a church building all week long, and so the.
Yeah, very good. Well, your kids are going to feel just much more comfortable in your presence. Don't you think? Yeah, I think you're going to have a lot of opportunities to demonstrate that when you go back to work. So, a question over here. Yes.
What if you had a client that I have one that's stuck, you would ask them a question like that, and they'd be like, "I can't think of anything all week. Couldn't think of anything to fill in the blank," or. Three more.
Would you mind? What's your name?
My name is Lindley.
Lindley, would you play a client?
Okay.
And pick one. Pick a category that your client would like you want to work on.
Or
what
she would
want to
work on? Gratitude.
Okay. Read it out loud.
Be aware of and thankful for the good things that happen, taking time to express thanks.
So, what's the client's name?
Samantha.
Samantha, the first thing I'd like you to do, beginning tonight, is to include gratitude prayers as you drop off to sleep. Now, who are you going to pray? Who are you going to thank God for tonight?
Maybe one friend.
Okay, that friend's name is Sally? Oh, so you're okay. So your prayer tonight, this is you're making a promise to me, a commitment to me now. You're going to pray, thanking God for Sally's presence in your life. Great. I'm glad that you're going to do that. Now, during the day, is there going to be an opportunity for you to get in contact with Sally?
Probably.
Would you be willing to send her a text? Would that be okay to say, "I'm just so glad that you're my friend"?
Yes, I can do that.
No, I don't want you to guess. I'm really asking you to make a commitment to me. It's really important. This is behavior change that's going to change you for the rest of your life, make you the person that God wants you to be.
I know she's so stubborn, she'd say no.
So
she says no.
Are you really wanting to bring about change in your life?
I think so.
No, I don't want you to think so. I want you to tell me yes or no.
Yes.
That is a very hesitant yes. Mm-hmm. Could you demonstrate to me by big brain about some changes today?
Okay.
That's true? I mean, you and I have a good relationship. I'm really challenging you here. I don't want you to be real angry with me, but I don't want to let you slip away. This is a really important opportunity.
Yeah.
So let's go back to Sally.
Okay.
Would you be willing to make a commitment to me to text Sally and tell her, "Thank you for being in my life"? You will do that. Okay. Now, I wonder if you'd be willing to follow that up with a phone call to Sally.
That'll be hard for me.
What if Sally were to call you? Would you answer the phone?
Yes.
Would you be willing to make a commitment to me to answer the phone if someone calls you?
Yes.
Good. Now, what's the hesitancy between you calling her and you answering the phone when she calls you?
Rejection.
Do you think she might not answer the phone?
No, I think she'll answer the phone, but I lose all my friends. I always lose all my friends. I always get betrayed.
Okay. Well, let's just stop with two today, then. I want you to just go ahead and have a successful day, and then when you go to sleep tonight, I want you to be able to thank God for Sally and appreciate that you've done these two things to bring about a change in your behavior. Okay? And I want you to do that and report back to me. Now, depending upon the recalcitrance of the client, I don't want to push the client so hard that I lose the client. But I also don't want to waste the opportunity. And so I might just start her out with, it's very, very rare that I let them just do, I let a client just do one a day. I want to challenge them to do two. So I might not go to three right away with her. But play it by ear.
Sure.
But because you want it to be a success experience.
Yeah.
You got to take the client where you find them.
Right.
Okay? Any other thoughts about this? Yes, please, Adam.
Can you say more about the Christian distinctives of this practice?
Say more about your question.
So, it strikes me that, and this is perhaps not a good nor bad, it strikes me that anyone could do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of their beliefs or faith commitments,
mm-hmm.
and that it would be a positive thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if there's something in particular that relationship with Jesus brings to this practice or permits or empowers about this practice.
It really has to do with what Christianity means. I think a person, I'm going to give you two answers that are both true. And this is, I've done this with some of my Jewish clients. We have a fairly large Jewish community among the faculty at two of the universities in St. Louis where I was practicing for years. And so I would have Jewish physicians and other professors come in. And I would work with them, and I'd use these strategies. Depending upon where they were with their own faith journey, and usually, I'll give you an example of a fellow who came to me because his father had died. He was just all broken up that he was had such this relationship with his dad, and he never told his dad he loved him. And his dad never told him how proud he was. This was a very famous physician in the country, really. A real expert in pediatric oncology. And his dad had never said, "I'm really proud of you." And so his dad died. He was just crushed by all this. And part of what I did with him was, part of it, not the whole, but was to go through this. And I think he picked kindness. I don't know if you can imagine how kind a good pediatric oncologist has to be. Well, you probably can. Is there a job that requires more kindness?
Whoa!
And he rated himself like at a 3. It was back when we used the 10-point scale, so it was like mid-range sometimes, 4 or 5. And so I'm thinking, this is a mismatch. And so we went through it, and I used the same system with him. I actually don't think we referenced it to Jesus, which was okay. But he worked on it, and over the course of the next day, what didn't take him very long, over the course of the next week, he had these three episodes. I mean, he had more than 3 episodes every single day where he was being extraordinarily kind. He came back in. I don't know what I was doing, and he re-rated himself at a higher level. So it's sometimes just it's like low-hanging fruit for some people, even if you're not a Christian. Let me give you the other part of it. For a Christ follower who is actually a Christ follower, who really looks at Jesus as the leader, if we're followers, we've got a leader, and we want our leader to be a paragon. We are looking for a paragon. And if you take a look at the 24 character strengths, in fact, I had my students do this, you can identify... Actually, we identified 560, I think it was, examples in the New Testament alone that related to Jesus exemplifying these character strengths as a paragon. So it's easy for people to fall away from their faith. This is a revigorization of the faith. Is that, if that's even a word? Invigorated of the invigoration of faith. And it relates to our day-to-day life, because we're actually asking people to demonstrate, what would Jesus do? And I want to be more like Jesus. And then I want to go to bed appreciating, saying in my prayer work before I drop off to sleep, feeding my hippocampus with information that is not going to have competing information, that I was more kind today than I was yesterday, or I was more whatever, vital today, more merciful today, more courageous today. So the Christian life gives us an opportunity to turbocharge this technology. And it allows us, because we're using Jesus as our standard, to have a paragon that's unquestioned and forgiving. So even if I rate myself low and I just in the suicidally depressed and I give myself ones and twos bumping along the bottom, I'm still, if I'm a Christ follower, if I can come back to Christ, consider maybe putting God back in my life, a lot of good can happen out of that, and not much bad. I do a lot of work with combat veterans. Combat veterans come back and often feel quite bad about themselves for lives they've taken. There's a moral injury that has occurred. And so they'll come in miserable for lots of reasons. PTSD, brain injury, depression. But at the core is this, I'm just a piece of shit because this wasn't something I was supposed to do. They trained me to do it. And I took all these lives, and there's no getting around that. But Jesus is all forgiving. God redeems us through the sacrifice of His Son, and if we can bring people back to that, and many people have been introduced to it as children, so we're reviving their spiritual life. Then we've done a lot of good. That's going to rebound for years to come. Let me just wrap this up by hitting on brain health and fitness. The same thing that happens with this sleep is an important part of what's called glymphatic clearance. That's a new term that was invented by some folks up at the Oregon Health Sciences Institute to talk about changes in the brain while we sleep that allow the extra proteins that have been developed over the course of the day to be drained by the cerebral spinal fluid. Each of our brains produces about half a liter of cerebral spinal fluid every day. It's always producing cerebral spinal fluid. We had no idea why that was the case. There was, what's the reason for cerebral spinal fluid? For until about 8 or 9 years ago, when people started to take a look, we can now visualize that the neurons that are active right now in your brain, because they're active, they're larger than they are when you're asleep. Yeah. Hmm. And so there's space between the neurons for the glial cells. You've got about 10 times as many glial cells that support the neurons in your brain. About 10 times as many. It takes, the glial cells do most of their work at night, helped by the cerebral spinal fluid. And there's a flushing that occurs. And so this issue that we have right now with people living long enough to get like Alzheimer's disease, which is the classic of about 50 different dementias. It's the classic dementia that has to do with excess proteins building up. If you get good sleep, a lot of that is taken care of. And there's some new research. It will blow your mind. You're going to start hearing about this in the next couple of years, because we've been doing it on mouse models, and now we're getting to a point where our technology is getting to the point where we can like prove it with, or at least demonstrate it with, human models. So, brain health and fitness is crucially tied into sleep. It's part of my background working with brain injured people all these years. The difference between getting a good night's sleep and not a good night's sleep is readily apparent with a brain injured person. Any of you who work, who've been around people who've had serious concussions, if they haven't had a good night's sleep, they're walking the door and you know it, versus if they have. Strokes the same way. People with Parkinson's the same way.
Brain development for adolescents and family, mm-hmm. things. And I'm just making all kind of applications in my head about what you say to your adolescent as you put them to bed, or
I start with the child.
Yeah.
Child's gratitude prayers are crucial. The last few messages the child's brain should get are of love, safety, acceptance, encouraging more effort. You can take a look. All of these apply to children. Working with adolescents who've been childhooded that way is quite easy. Working with adolescents who are struggling in adolescence, we need to take, if they're willing to, be rational about things, take a more fact-based approach, encouraging them to take some responsibility for developing their brains. Kelly was talking about the pleasure centers in the brain being accessed and overstimulated by social media in the talk before this. Absolutely true. So we can't tell kids not to text, not to sext, not to do things on their phones that they should not be doing unless we have a basis in fact. They won't accept it from us. You wouldn't back when you were 16, 15 years old. But the basis is that now the technology, in terms of neuroscience, fits with faith. Paul was right. You cannot read the New Testament with the head on hip on about neuroscience and not realize that this is God's plan. My faith came about out of neuroscience. Attending church with a very patient wife while I listened to pastors talk about the Bible, and I thought they were talking about neuroscience. I would go up afterwards and I'd say, did you know blah, 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 their high school glaze over, and they'd ask for the security guards to come in close. But I'm excited about this, and I wrote the book really to demonstrate that. Your faithful brain designed for so much more is the subtitle, because we are designed for so much more. If you don't get that before you die, it's a loss. Your faith is so exciting now because we know about how the brain actually was designed.
So how does that tie in with as someone has a cognitive decline in their elderly, mm-hmm. In terms of what you sleep and what you speak to them at the time of that you want them to sleep?
So Lillian's mother, Casey, called me 2 days ago. My mom went in to see the doc, and he administered the Montreal cognitive assessment that she has for me. It's a dementia screening scheme. And so he said, the doc said, not looking too good. And so I said, and I gave Lillian the directions, and I've worked with her mom for years before. I told Lillian, get her back to sleep. Has she been sleeping well? Well, no, her dog was really sick for the past 3 months, and so she had to be up several times during the night because the dog, without being attended, would throw up or poop. So her mom's gone for 3 months taking care of a very sick dog. One of her best friends died. Some other thing happened, and so I said, what do you think about her sleep? Well, it's been terrible. And she went in and did the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. For me, there's a link between the two. And I said, Lillian, she probably needs to have her medications looked at in terms of the antidepressants she's on. She needs to be helped with sleep. But don't do a lot that's really drastic until she gets back to a good sleep regimen. At least for a person with a brain injury, she came to me because she'd fallen and had a concussion, and they were concerned that it was actually dementia. It wasn't. It was this fall. This was about 6 years ago. But now she's 70 years old, so they are concerned about dementia. So I said, don't do much that's really dramatic until you really get to sleep. Be real serious about the sleep. And get 5 sleep cycles for a person with a brain injury or dementia, or something that looks like dementia. You get problems with over medication, insomnia that mimic dementia. I'm not saying people don't have dementia. It's a real problem. But it's exacerbated dramatically by not getting good sleep, and also by the improper use of some medications.
So sleep apnea would...
Oh, it's a big deal.
Correct.
Sleep apnea has to be dealt with.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much.